Hello, good evening, today and good afternoon, and welcome to a Fireside Chat. This is your host, Lance White, otherwise known as Zany Mystic at times. I have a really exciting show for us today. I have two guests on, and one is, his name is Bill Ryan. I'll give you a little background. He has degrees in mathematics and physics, followed that with teaching. For the last 27 years, he has been a management consultant, specializing in personal and team development. And in November 2005, he inaugurated the Project Serpo website, the report of an alleged disclosure of a U.S. alien exchange program claimed to have taken place over 40 years ago. While he had been interested in UFOs, free energy research, and alternative medicine, and is also trained as a kinesiologist, that's a good one, that's a 50-cent word, for over 30 years, his first contact with the UFO community at large occurred after establishing the famous Serpo website. And I'm also very fortunate to have the producer and director and so on of the television shows, which interview people such as John Lear, Dan Burrish, Gary McKinnon, and others, and that's Carrie Cassidy. She has a BA in English with graduate work in sociology, and after 19 years in Hollywood working for major studios and independent production companies, she has written a number of screenplays, acquired the movie rights to The Wingmaker Story in 2003, and started work on her own UFO documentary in 2005. She has completed 3 interviews for Project Camelot, possibly more, and is planning 21 more over the coming months. Without further ado, let's say hello and welcome both Bill Ryan and Carrie Cassidy. Hello.
Well, hi there. It's a pleasure to be here. I hope you can hear us okay. Does this sound good enough to you?
It could be a tad louder, but...
Let's just try that again. Can
that's
I hear
better.
It now properly?
That's better.
Okay, fine.
Okay, hi. This is Carrie.
Hi, Carrie. Welcome. Okay, I think the audience would like to know, have a little bit of background about what got you started in UFOs. And you're actually working right now on a project called Project Camelot. But I think that all kind of began with Project Serpo. Is that correct?
Yes. If I could answer my half of the question first,
yes.
As it were.
Okay.
I stumbled into my involvement with Project Serpo quite by accident back last November when I was on a private email list which was being moderated by a guy called Victor Martinez.
Mm-hmm.
And he started to receive information from an anonymous source about a claimed U.S. alien exchange program that took place back in the 1960s and 70s. All of this is chronicled in an enormous amount of detail on a website that's called serpo.org.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just the guy in the audience, as it were, back then, who stuck my hand up and rather innocently, and in retrospect a little naively, I just said, well, you know, if we need a website to archive this information and present it to the public, then I'd be delighted to do that because I had a little bit of time on my hands.
Uh-huh.
And what I didn't anticipate was that that would be the thin end of a very large wedge indeed, because a lot of good people like yourself started to approach me for interviews about this fascinating subject, because everyone else was behind the curtains and was anonymous, and they didn't have anyone else to talk to, so I became the kind of unofficial spokesperson for this whole thing. What also happened, and this is very relevant to take us to the present moment,
okay,
was on the contact form on the website where people were free just to write in with any comments and questions and information which they might have to offer.
Uh-huh.
I started to be the recipient of a lot of extraordinary information from some very interesting people who just wanted to get it off their chest and tell somebody.
Mm.
One of the first of those was a character who has become known since then, as Mr. X. It's a slightly unfortunate title, which was which he was given by Jerry Pippin, in fact. And this man, Mr. X, who we've now since come to know quite well, came forward with an extraordinary story, nothing to do with SOPO whatsoever, but he worked as an archivist for an aerospace company back in the 1980s, when for a period of 6 months he had intensive personal exposure to government documents, files, photographs, alien artifacts, which he held in his hands.
Wow.
And he said that he'd like us, or he'd like me at that point, to help him to get his story out. And that was one of the germs of the idea that subsequently became Project Camelot. What Camelot is, it's not directly connected with SOPO, but it was partially inspired by that, because while we're calling this this man Mr. X, there are tens of thousands of others, just as Stephen Greer has demonstrated with his disclosure project.
Yes.
There are a large number of people who have been afraid to come forward, who have extraordinary stories to tell. And what Project Camelot is, it's a sort of alternative disclosure project. We fully support what Stephen Greer is doing. We're not, you know, there's no competition. We're all working towards the same goals here.
Right.
But ours is just a little bit broader, because we want to recognize that whistleblowers in the field of ufology also have a lot in common with whistleblowers in the fields of alternative medicine, free energy research, anti-gravity research.
Mm-hmm.
There are many fields here. They don't tend to talk to each other very much, but many of those individuals, individual researchers and experimenters, have experienced a lot of suppression at the hands of the powers that be, who have vested interests and who don't want whatever information is being held by these individuals to be made public. And so Project Camelot was conceived as a kind of Arthurian ideal, the kind of round table which all of us can sit round. None of us is better or more significant or senior to anybody else. We're all in this together, and we need to get these stories out. We want to make it safe. We will safeguard all confidentiality. The first thing which we want to say to any of your listeners, if there's anybody there who has been sitting on an important story which they have been uncomfortable about revealing because they're worried about what the consequences might be, we have the resources to check the story out, to do anonymous interviews, to protect their identity, and to make this available to a wider public. And it was both Kerry and myself who coined this idea between us last April, and since then it's been rolling along quite well, because Kerry is a filmmaker and she has a lot of experience in working with individuals in this way. I'd just like to invite Kerry into the conversation.
Yes, absolutely.
She can say her own thing about this.
Actually, you're covering it pretty well, Bill, so I don't really have anything specific to add. You know, if there's a direct question in regard to kind of what Bill's gone over, maybe I can add to that.
Well, one question that's just come up from what you've said is, you've interviewed some pretty well-known people, like Dan Burrish and Gary McKinnon and Bill Lear and so on and so forth. What about those people who are really afraid for their lives? Can you do an anonymous interview where, say, their face is facing another direction and their voice is muffled, or is that...
I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to all the interviews. I know they're quite lengthy. Our Mr. X was that kind of an interview. He's facing away from the camera. We do not reveal his appearance. In fact, his... details about him and his whereabouts, et cetera, have all been kept completely confidential.
Absolutely.
His voice is disguised, both on our interview, which is video, and also on Jerry Pippin's interview. Jerry Pippin also interviewed him.
And let people know what your site is so they can see that.
So this would be projectcamelot.org.
Okay.
And just click on interviews. And there are about six interviews up there so far. There are a few others. The way that I got involved with this, by the way, is because I was going around making the preliminary part of my UFO documentary, and I was doing interviews on the spot at various conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And at Laughlin, I interviewed Bill, which is how we met.
Yeah.
And from that, we sort of brainstormed the idea behind Project Camelot. And it seems to be growing in leaps and bounds. We're getting an incredible response.
Oh,
and
good.
We're contacted by all kinds of people that are in positions of confidentiality, who don't want to be revealed. We're finding out all kinds of information. And I do want to say, I guess just to add to that a bit, is that we are not considering ourselves a judge and jury of this information. When someone comes to us, we use whatever means we have, which is not much more than the normal person, to do some investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Both of us have a background in this material as private researchers for probably, you know, going on 10 years
mm-hmm.
A piece. So we are very familiar with the sort of topic and with the ins and outs of who's who in the world
mm-hmm.
of sort of ufology or exopolitics. So we definitely kind of know, as well as we're both intuitives, if you will,
mm-hmm.
And empaths. So
we
have sort of more than one dimension, access to more than one dimension at our disposal to determine what's true and what's not.
Yes. That's interesting you should mention that, because when I read the Project Serpo site some months ago, I was writing a column for iPod, and I was asked if I thought it was real, and I said, well, I think that there are bits and pieces in there that are probably based upon the truth, but that they've been, you know, either dramatized or changed for disinformation purposes. And it was interesting to read your mentioning the Serpo stuff. I read the whole interview with Bill, and it was very interesting. I recommend that people go to your site and read this stuff. It's just fascinating.
Oh, thank you. By the way, you go by Zany Mystic, isn't that right?
Correct.
Okay, I just wanted to say that I'm part of the iPod forum,
and
I often see your posts.
Oh.
So, and I think you're quite smart, and I've enjoyed reading, you know, your responses to things.
Oh, well, thank you.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Are you familiar with Frank Riccardi's iPod site?
Yes, very, very much. In fact, we just interviewed GL, if you know,
oh, yes,
the author of Alien Mind,
yes,
and we're going
yes.
to be posting that to our site in, you know, probably a few weeks' time.
Oh, wonderful. That's really great. You know, I am so excited about this field because it's just, you know, it's really the wave of the future, and it takes a lot of courage for people to stand up and do this, because I've personally known people, and I hope that you can share a few stories about this as well, who have lost their homes, their wives, or their children, because they had information that was not that someone didn't want it to get out.
Absolutely. In fact, I don't know if you know, and you probably do if you're part of the iPod situation, but mm-hmm. Frank Riccardi is one of those people.
Yes.
And it's been my goal, as a matter of fact, to interview him. I'm going to say that on your radio show.
Yeah.
And he knows. I've actually met him in person, and he's a wonderful guy.
Yes,
he is. Fabulous. And I think that he's, you know, it would be really wonderful if people could kind of meet him and see him interviewed.
And I think it might help with his situation.
It could. That's actually part of the motto of Project Camelot, is to hide in plain sight.
Yes, absolutely.
As being the best way to sort of safeguard your own livelihood and your life and family.
Yes, when people start having mysterious heart attacks that don't go away, I get worried.
Right. And you know, we have another case in point along those lines, and I'm going to turn this over to Bill to let him explain, but we recently also interviewed Ralph Ring, who worked with Otis Carr on Tesla Technologies and actually built a flying saucer. His group was disbanded by the FBI, and this happened back in the 1960s, and he's an elderly man now, and he just went into the hospital in some suspicious circumstances. Almost lost his life
yeah.
over a small routine operation, I guess it was.
It was a knee operation. It was a knee replacement operation. It was just one of these things that just makes you raise your eyebrows. This man had never had a day's illness in his life. I met with him back in March, and he told me his incredible story of his experiences working with Otis Carr. All of this is on our website. And he told me a huge amount of information, and the outcome of that was that I promised that I would assist him to get this information into the hands of people who would be able to duplicate this research. Because one of the happy consequences of the activity that Kerry and I have been involved in over the last few years is we developed an awful lot of contacts. And he said, yeah, you know, this is great. I really appreciate this. I haven't known what to do with it. He's got scrapbooks and photographs and blueprints and all sorts of things of this amazing information that of his research with Otis Carr back in the 50s and 60s. And then there was a silence for a long time. Next thing we know, as Kerry just explained, he'd gone into hospital for a routine knee replacement operation. He was given the wrong medication by accident. He nearly died three times. And it's just like, no one can prove that there's a connection, but I'm one of these people, and I know Kerry is as well, who looks upon most coincidences as being likely to have some significance, whether we understand what the significance is.
Oh, absolutely.
And if this guy was going to get all his information out, and then suddenly he nearly dies in one of these hospital accidents, it just makes you wonder.
Well, it's worse than that, because when you see that that's the standard operating procedure for these rogue black operations, then you realize that these things are all interconnected, that scientists disappearing and people's houses burning down, and they tend to like to use the heart attack method most, it seems, but basically they'll use anything they can, and it's, I think it's pretty common to people who are involved with this kind of stuff to see this over and over and over. So it's not really, you know, people who don't know about it when they hear it the first time may think that it sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it's really not. There's a massive effort to keep information suppressed from us, and it's information that would benefit all of mankind. And so this is the kind of thing that I'm trying to encourage others to come out about, and to, you know, if there's anybody out there that has information or, you know, stories to tell, that it all helps.
Yeah, if I can just jump in there.
Yes.
As a part of our site and as a part of what Project Camelot stands for, we are paying tribute to quite a considerable number of people in various fields, not only in UFO research, but in alternative medicine and free energy research, who have actually paid with their lives having the courage to speak out and live by their principles. There's a page where there are click-through links to all of these individuals. Some are well-known names, some of them are not so well-known, but whether they're known or not, they deserve to be remembered, because all of these people have extraordinary courage. There are an even larger number of people who we haven't got around to referencing yet, who haven't actually paid with their lives, but they've been paid by, you know, having their dog poisoned, or having an Inland Revenue search on them, or being imprisoned, or being bankrupted, or maybe just having mysteriously coming down with some debilitating illness. It is a dangerous world, but what we invite people to do is to contact us and add their names to a pledge. It's what we call the Roundtable Pledge, which basically says, and I'll say this for myself right now, it's if it appears at any future time that I have committed suicide, then I want the world to know that this is murder. I do not intend to take my own life. I'm in good health. There is no indication whatsoever that I will succumb to a heart attack. If I have a heart attack tomorrow after doing this interview, then the world can know that there's something suspicious. What tends to happen now is that, exactly as you mentioned, in the past, the powers that be resorted to more primitive means. Like, they'd run you off the road with a truck, or they'd shoot you in the head or something.
Right.
It's just a little bit obvious, you know. And now, as you rightly say, there are ways for, you know, a white van to pull up on the street 100 meters away and to induce a heart attack with some
destructive
beam. It's really, really important that we are not afraid of that, because the more that we are scared of this, then we give them power. The more power we give by our acquiescence and our silence, the more things will stay exactly the same.
And the more we lose.
And the more we lose, the more we collectively lose. So what we're doing is we're taking a stand, and we invite people to join us. This is what Project Camelot stands for.
Mm-hmm.
It actually is about that stand. It's about saying we will not be silenced. We are going to come forward. If one whistleblower comes forward with all, you know, with all his contact details and his photograph, then maybe it will take a lot of courage for them to do so, although some people have. If a large number of people do so, then you've got a movement, and you can't silence them all.
That's right. And it's important to remember that it all starts with one person.
It all starts with one person, and it's hard to identify who that one person is.
I think they know who it is.
Because a lot of people have come forward under their own names, under the Disclosure Project.
Right,
you really
right.
salute Stephen Greer and all of his witnesses for the stand that they have taken.
Mm.
We want to move this on. We want to take it forward. We encourage other projects and other groups to come forward with this as well. This
mm-hmm.
has to be a rolling snowball.
And also, one of the things that we're doing that the Disclosure Project perhaps stopped a bit early on, which was we make our interviews instantly available for free on the web.
Mm-hmm.
That's the step we're taking, so that people can, you know, it's not always easy for people to, you know, to read a 500-page book.
Mm-hmm.
But as the people come forward, then we basically interview them and get it right up there.
Well, I think that's a brilliant idea.
Thank you.
I'm all for it. I mean, I'll be shouting from the rooftop on this one.
Well, that's very kind.
That's wonderful. And if there's anything that you or your listeners can do to help get this word out, this is what we want. It's a network. It's a movement. We want people to contact us. We want people to we invite people to put their names to our pledge, so that they too are saying whether they've got a story to tell or whether they haven't got a story to tell. Just to say, you know, we stand by this, and we're not going to be silenced. We're not going to be suppressed by the powers that be. It's so important to make that public statement.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't know if you have this on your site, but I was thinking as you spoke about Ralph Raine that it might be a nice, it might be a good idea to have a section where you can just simply throw up information or put up information about people who are having health problems, for instance, just say, and just have a list of people, you know, so-and-so is in the hospital, and then keep following it up on them, because once it's on the public eye, there's scrutiny there.
That's a very interesting idea. We certainly are interested in expanding our website, so if there was something we could do along those lines, we'd probably be willing to do it. The only thing that we could say on that note, though, would be, obviously, you know, unless we know about it, we're not going to be able to put anybody's
right.
name up.
Right.
So along the same lines, we're also interested in having people send in names and point us to histories that are not already noted in our
right.
tribute section.
We're
happy to see that grow and grow and grow. And we really started out small, just because the human, you know, right now it's just the two of us working on the site and the interviews, so we have a huge amount of work to do.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, that's a great idea.
Well, thank you. Now, I know that the listeners are going to, I had a whole, this is such a good conversation, we could probably talk for hours. But I do have some questions, because this whole UFO thing is so difficult to unravel, because it seems that you know, there's so little evidence out there. Have you run across I think you mentioned that who was it that you said had artifacts and pictures and
Mr.
various
X.
other things? Can you
He's
talk a little
Mr.
bit
X.
about some of the things that you've seen personally that you can share with us?
No, he was an archivist
okay.
in a defense contractor, major well-known defense contractor,
right?
Company where he actually did this work in secret in a vault, in a sort of top secret situation under which he was under constant surveillance.
Uh-huh.
And basically, the rest of the company didn't know about what he was doing at the time.
Uh-huh.
A small group was asked if they wanted to do a special assignment, and he worked on this for 6 months.
Uh-huh.
Unbeknownst to them, he was a UFO buff, I guess, at the time.
Oh.
And this was back in the 1980s. And so he was overjoyed to actually get documents in his hands that validated things like the Roswell crash.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
So, and this is a guy who does not want to be known. Does not, you know, his wife is very afraid for anything that might kind of reveal their circumstance and put them in any kind of jeopardy. He's a very, they're a wonderful couple, and he's a very charming, sort of self-effacing guy, and he absolutely is not, you know, wanting fame or fortune
right.
from any of this.
Right.
So he just came forward when he read on the SERPO site that there was a contact form, and Bill began a dialogue with him.
Mm-hmm.
And what we, you know, like I said, basically that's what's going on. Project Camelot has also the same kind of form where people can, you know, send us information about themselves or about a situation in which they were a part of, and then we take it from there. The thing that we're offering also is to publicize these things in terms of whatever the person wants.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, letting them basically dictate the terms.
Okay.
You understand?
Did he indicate that he was working on something that he thought might be back engineering?
As a matter of fact, back engineering did not seem to be a lot of part of what he read.
Okay.
What he came across were things that validated the relationship with the Greys, the fact that there was an exchange of technology, that there was something called there were larger beings called the Oranges.
Huh.
That seemed to also play a part, documentation basically that talked about crashes, talked about the proper, you know, retrieval procedures and so on, that kind of thing. So that's kind of what, and again, go to the interview. There's a written transcript interview with him on the site, as well as the video interview.
Okay.
You get it both ways. And he's also been interviewed since he contacted us. This is another thing we can do for people, which is he got an interview with Jerry Pippen, as mm-hmm. I said, and also on Coast to Coast, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm saying here is that we become sort of a conduit
yes.
to getting the story out in whatever means or media we can make possible. And that includes making movies, by the way. I'm a screenwriter, and we do have various movies in the works that haven't actually gotten funding yet, but
uh-huh.
certainly hoping for something along those lines, and as a matter of fact, we're looking to do something along those lines with SERPO.
Mm-hmm. That would make a fascinating movie, and I think it would be a big winner, a big hit.
Yeah, we think so.
And I foresee a time when your funding will come through, and you'll be able to do these things. I just have a funny feeling that there's a tipping point that's occurring right now, and once that happens, the money will free up and go into those places that have been neglected for so very long.
Yeah. One of the interesting things here, which you sort of referred to tangentially just a few minutes ago,
mm-hmm.
is the problem of spreading the word about whatever this truth is in the wider population.
Mm-hmm.
You and we and your listeners can talk to each other until the cows come home,
mm-hmm.
as it were. And yet, to some degree, with minor differences of opinion, we're all really preaching to the choir.
Right.
There are billions of people out there who neither know nor care.
That's true.
And to some degree, it's such a specialist, arcane subject of study that what really needs to be done is the information needs to break out of this little enclave into the broader public.
Yes.
And we've had a lot of conversations between ourselves about this, and this is really where the mainstream media come in. Now, the New York Times and the, you know, and the Times of London are probably heavily controlled. They're unlikely to start splashing front page headlines about, you know, information that is being revealed about crash disks in the desert. This isn't going to happen. And if anyone thinks that this may happen, that we're going to have a 60-minute special anytime soon, they're probably
going to wait,
being a little bit too hopeful.
Yes.
But what we have seen in recent years is we have seen a lot of television specials. We've seen a lot of series on television. We've seen, you know, Star Wars. We've seen Star Trek. We've seen E.T. We've seen Close Encounters. And this is one way, as many of your listeners will understand, that the public has become more aware and more familiar with and more comfortable with the idea of ET contact and an ET presence.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is really the reason why, in our opinion, the SOPO story, that whatever the truth or otherwise of the details, there is quite a lot of persuasive circumstantial evidence that some kind of exchange program did occur.
Mm-hmm.
And the very concept of the human race establishing communications with an alien species and going, you know, being invited into their backyard to see what kind of culture they have,
mm-hmm.
and to spend some time on their home planet. It's a real archetype. It's
mm-hmm.
a modern-day equivalent of what it took for Leif Erikson to set sail across the Atlantic in the
mm-hmm.
Viking ships for the New World.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's exactly the same thing, and that spirit of kind of adventure and discovery and reaching out for contact is something that's an archetype in the human race. Even
mm-hmm.
if we go back thousands of years to when some ape man stood upon a cliff and wondered if he could get across to an island that he could see a couple of miles away,
mm-hmm.
it's exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It reaches very deeply into all of us. And if something like that could be made into some kind of a mainstream feature in whatever form, it would just help to spread the word. You
mm-hmm.
know, and then of course it's possible just to have those magical words at the end of an exciting movie, you know, like that little paragraph that you get in brackets at the end that says, this is based upon a true story.
Yeah.
Read this book or something, you know. We're certainly not doing this to make any money out of it, but we are intent on trying to spread the word by any workable means.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that there are a number of other people who have very similar ideas. We don't care who does it. It just needs to get out there.
Well, you know, Whitley Strieber just came out with his book, The Grays, and I think that will make will have some impact on society. And it seems like we're at a point where we just need to have the door opened a little wider for a larger volume of information to come through. And unfortunately, as you said, the media is controlled. And stories just don't hit the mainstream media because they can't. You know, they're just not permitted to report on this kind of thing. Everything, you know.
Right, but I would say that, you know, I'm in the process of reading Whitley's book. And
yeah, me too.
It's quite fascinating. He's revealing some very interesting nuances
uh-huh.
to what his prior contact experiences must have contained. And have you read it, by
I'm
the way?
Working on it right now.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating.
yes.
And you're right. I mean, that's case in point. This, he's actually referencing some Hollywood people, giving thanks to them in the beginning of the book. So I'm sure it's going to be a movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it'll be pretty fascinating. But, you know.
And Steven Spielberg's Taken.
I'm sorry?
Steven Spielberg's series, miniseries called Taken.
Oh, which was quite well done. Yes, absolutely. What's happening, though, is that there's a groundswell really from the masses
mm-hmm.
that is changing the way we do media, period. So
mm-hmm.
that, you know, the major media is actually losing a lot of its control, all because of the internet. I mean, mm-hmm. this is the power that is out there, and at the hands of all of us right now. And
mm-hmm.
and really, people are just running with it. I mean, it's just an incredible, incredible medium.
Well, we have to.
As a case in point, Project Camelot would not exist were it not for the web.
Yes.
And our interviews, one thing that it's important to note is that I did work for Hollywood for probably about 20 years in various capacities, but I never was able to move beyond the point where they would actually give me the reins and let me direct or produce anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually had to go out on my own, picking up a camera on my own. And it's only because of digital technology that's allowed me to go out, buy the equipment, you know, get a Mac, do the editing myself. You see, this is what's available to us now, and it's only going to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So my point is that the major media out there is actually turning around and starting to look at places like us and other filmmakers who are kind of forging ahead,
mm-hmm.
not looking to them for guidance,
mm-hmm.
you know, but being the leaders ourselves.
Well, yes.
Saying,
yes.
Look, this is how it can be done. You know, let's get rid of these barriers and,
yes.
and open it up.
Absolutely.
You know, open the discussion up, whether it's about UFOs, mm-hmm. alternative health, or you name it.
Free energy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we are not powerless in this equation, and on the contrary, our power is growing.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Before you started this, let me ask you this. You've met some interesting people. What's the most compelling story or evidence that you've heard from some of these people about the existence of extraterrestrials and UFOs?
Wow, that's a hard one.
Yeah, I know.
We are interviewing, as you can see, Dan Burrish, John Lear. I've interviewed a lot of others besides that before I ever got involved in Project Camelot. And, I mean, researchers that are doing some amazing work.
Well,
there's just a huge amount out there. To say one thing is more compelling than another, it kind of depends on your proclivity for what you consider to be true or untrue and what you consider to be good evidence.
Uh-huh.
Some people are really all about the hard evidence. You
right.
know what I mean? In other words,
show me the
like,
money.
like Ryan Wood and Bob Wood are doing some fantastic work with their Majestic site, and they're looking at documentation. And they can take you through a document and tell you if it's, you know, when it's dated, whether it's, you know, you can rely on it to be authentic and this and that. That's great work. And they're also, Ryan has been documenting crash retrievals across the United States
mm-hmm.
and in his latest book. And that's wonderful work. For me, that's not really where it's at. Personally, I'm more interested in the, I guess, if you will, the spiritual and what I, because I'm an empath, I can sense when,
mm-hmm.
when there's truth to something.
Me too.
And this is actually why I came across the Wingmakers material and wanted to get involved with that, because I could sense on a more psychic, intuitive level that the real truth was in that material.
Uh-huh.
And finding, you know, a piece of a spaceship is, you know, it's all very fine and good, but I've gone way beyond, you know, whether or not aliens are here and
right.
you know, and they fly around in machinery.
Right,
you know
right.
what I'm saying? It's kind of like there's a lot more going on than that.
Oh, absolutely. There's something I read last night before I went, and I want to talk a little bit about the Wingmakers too, but something, you mentioned Dan Burrish, and I was reading before I went to bed one of the interviews that you guys did, and this just struck me between the eyes. It says, Dan discusses his experiences in Area 51, where he befriended a captive J-Rod called Chiela, and his complex relationship extending across decades and timelines, his connection with Majestic 12, and this is where I started highlighting, the war between Majestic and the Illuminati, the race to close down the Looking Glass technology and secure the man-made stargates leading up to 2012, and the activation of the man-made stargates, and the twists and turns of the convergent timeline paradox that affects the aliens from the future. Now, this there's a lot there.
Pretty convoluted stuff.
Yes. I do a lot of research on the Mayan 2012 stuff, and, of course, on stargates as well. Can you elaborate a little bit on what they're talking about, at least in terms of the war between the Majestic and the Illuminati? And is that an internal... Did he go into details about that?
Well, his interview is extremely long. It's actually three segments that you can download, and
right.
I'm told by people out there that it's taking quite a while, and it's hard to download all that information. You really need a high-speed connection.
Right.
But we do have a DVD that's going to be coming out in the near future. We are going to be packaging various things onto DVDs for people that don't have, web access that's really speedy and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes, one of the most fascinating things that we were able to talk to Dan about was that the idea behind what was going on with Majestic 12, because he had so many dealings with them,
mm-hmm.
and the Illuminati, and the fact that there is, which a lot of people, it's not like common knowledge,
mm-hmm.
that there is this war going on. And the war also trickles down to the agencies, the alphabet agencies, as it were. CIA, DIA
mm-hmm.
are also on either sides of the spectrum, as far
mm-hmm.
as whether disclosure happens, how it happens, and when it happens. So a lot of the war is about that, really in a nutshell, although the Illuminati are and the Bilderbergers and so on are basically on one side of the fight,
mm-hmm.
if you will,
mm-hmm.
and the Majestic 12 consider themselves to be on the other. Now, what we learned from Dan, and what we probably, if you were part of this or if you've been investigating this at all, you'd know that members of the MJ-12 are also at times have been and are part of the Illuminati.
Mm-hmm.
So the waters are muddied
mm-hmm.
by this kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
So not all the members of Majestic 12 are for, if you... disclosure, per se.
Right.
In the way that we might think about it. And so they do work against the basic, agenda. But what happens is that Dan goes into detail about this, and rather than sort of tell you what Dan had to say,
right.
I think the best thing to do is to ask you and your listeners to go and listen to his really fascinating sort of expose when he was prompted by my questions to go into that area.
Oh, good, good. Well, then I'll save that for when I have time.
And then come back to us, and we can maybe talk about it. And the interesting thing about Dan Burrish is that, he's got a huge group of people on one side of the fence that, that think he's a complete fraud.
Mm.
And then he's got people on the other side that think he's, the real thing.
Mm.
He's a very mixed bag in terms of what his background is. And what he's been put through as well.
Mm-hmm.
And but I have to say that, from our standpoint, meeting him and Marcy McDowell, who works with him
mm-hmm.
on all of this stuff, was really quite fascinating. And they're wonderful people just on the level of human beings. So just to sit in a room and talk is very easygoing and very natural and very, very comfortable. So
mm-hmm.
it's not... it's quite interesting how when we're lucky enough in this situation to be able to go and meet these people who have some of them huge images in the UFO network and
mm-hmm.
find out that when you meet them up close they're really really nice kind individuals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some have been accused wrongly of being all kinds of things, which is really
yes.
extraordinary.
Isn't a lot of that just kind of disinformation?
Well, there's that for sure.
Yeah.
That's definitely at work.
So
just in answer to your question, closing the stargates,
yes.
the looking glass technology, this is really fascinating stuff. It's also fairly sophisticated, and I could go into it to some degree because I do understand it,
mm-hmm.
but I hesitate to do so simply because they could get it from Dan, who is, you know, and who is much more versed in this than I.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just step in here if I could, because I might be able to do like a 25-second elevator speech about the problem of the 2012 timelines. Apparently, and all I am doing here is I'm trying to condense Dan's claims about the timelines issue.
Uh-huh.
He says that the extraterrestrials who we know as the Greys are in fact ourselves from the future, 45,000 years ahead. It's a little bit more complicated than that because there are other groups from the future with various degrees of malevolence or benevolence towards us.
Yes.
And they have come back in time. Some of them have come back in time to try and fix the problem that caused a massive catastrophe on this planet in 2012, as the Mayan prophecies depict. And according to Dan, these interventions, the complex series of interventions, they are working. He talks about Timeline 1 and Timeline 2, or T1 and T2 for short.
Uh-huh.
Timeline 2 is bad news, because that result, what happens in Timeline 2, or if you take it from a future standpoint, what happened in Timeline 2 is that there was very intense and catastrophic solar activity that triggered the man-made stargates, which is what is known as the looking glass technology. Looking glass technology is an artificial project. It's called Project Looking Glass. You can look it up on the web. It's taken place in highly classified research establishments, and basically these are time travel portals which have been artificially created. These, and that's what's known colloquially as a stargate. There are also naturally occurring stargates in various places on the planet, which is a whole different story. Now, what happens, or from the future standpoint, what happened, is that this intense solar activity triggered the man-made stargates in the Looking Glass projects to such a degree that something was precipitated, something was activated that came out of control that then triggered a whole load of Earth changes, major Earth changes that over a period of time killed, according to Dan, 94% of the Earth's population.
Mm.
Now, that's bad news, and that's worthwhile trying to prevent.
Mm-hmm.
And what Dan says is that all these man-made stargates have now been closed down. In other words, they've unplugged them, they've dismantled them, they've done whatever they need to do to disable them, so that this cannot now happen.
And part of going into Iraq was part of that effort, supposedly, and there was some negotiations with Gaddafi as well that ended up closing some of the stargates, the man-made stargates.
Uh-huh.
It's a very, very complicated story, but that's the essence.
It depends whether you buy that. You know, the trouble is that some of what is said, you know, you have to use discernment. So the listener or the viewer, as it were, who views the video and listens to Dan speak, you have to decide how much is being revealed that's true, if it's only a partial truth, and whether it's has any basis whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
But it's a very interesting idea, and certainly bears investigation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to close up on that, what Dan says the current situation is, and this has been established using looking glass technology, which is, by its very nature, is able to look into the future.
Uh-huh.
And of course, if you've got a changing future, because you've got one timeline that's kind of morphing into another one, then you get some very strange effects that can be analyzed by a computer, apparently. He said that the current situation is that the disastrous Timeline 2 is currently being avoided with 85% probability. In other words, we've got a pretty good chance of getting away with it.
Okay.
Which is not to say that timeline one does not involve some catastrophes and
right.
some loss of life and some earth changes.
Right.
What they actually talk about is that if timeline two doesn't happen, then you revert to something of what was referred to in the Bible in terms of, you know, sort of Armageddon-like occurrences. And I think what's happening, and if you follow the Wingmakers material, you also hear, is that some of this, again, has been mitigated so that it's not going to be as drastic as perhaps it once was considered to be.
Yeah.
Now, this is again, you know, a story. This is not necessarily what exactly is going to happen.
Right.
Yeah. Once again, all we're doing here is we're trying to be the messenger and the interpreter for this information. As Kerry said about half an hour ago, earlier on in this interview, we're not trying to be judge and jury over this, but we do feel that this interview that Dan was generous enough to give us is probably one of the best on the web in terms of making it very clear what it is that he stands for.
Mm.
And the paradox here is that this is almost unbelievable information. You know, it's information that strains anyone's credulity. It strains our credulity,
right.
let alone that of the man in the street. And at the same time, here we are, talking with this guy, meeting him in person, sitting down over a cup of coffee and sharing stories, and the guy is completely sincere. He's a lovely man. He's somebody who I would be pleased and proud to call my friend. And this information is crazy.
Well, it's not that crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends on one's standpoint. When I say crazy, I'm saying this with lots of inverted commas around it. I'm not saying that I think it's crazy. I'm just highlighting the nature of the paradox, because
right.
a lot of people have turned against Dan because this information is either not believable or they don't want to believe it. And
right.
I understand people who have either of those standpoints. It's really difficult to get a handle on this stuff.
Well,
and at the same time, as I said before, what we want to report is that the guy, in our opinion, is clearly sincere in what he's saying. There's absolutely no doubt about it. He's not lying. He's not hoaxing.
And by the same token, and we don't probably want to make this whole interview about this material, but he has also clearly been tortured, and will admit to this,
mm-hmm.
By, and I'm not sure exactly who, but at the, you know, sort of whether MJ-12 was in charge of that or what the story is.
Mm-hmm.
But he's been manipulated. He is himself. If you listen to the interview, you'll find out about his early origins, that he himself was genetically engineered to sort of be a messenger for the Majestic 12, as a matter of fact, and that he's got scars. He's under poor health.
Hmm.
He's got a scar at the back of his head that's quite long. He has undergone incredible things in order to get to this place. He's also clearly a scientist, by the way.
Uh-huh.
Many people question that about him. To tell you the truth, his real love is science. It's very clear when you talk with him. He's very well versed. He knows exactly what he's talking about. In fact, I would say that he's actually quite brilliant in that area.
Do any of the people that you've interviewed tie in the HARP technology or chemtrails into what's going on? Does that figure into it at all?
Yes, actually. John Lear, that we just talked to about that, and I mentioned to John something that I've been aware of, which is that the HARP technology seems to be erecting an electromagnetic net over the United States and, in fact, large parts of the world, and that it has a lot more to do with the extraterrestrial creating a barrier against the extraterrestrial visitations than it does to some of the things it's claiming to do.
Mm.
And I also, and he agreed with me, by the way.
Mm.
And I also have noticed that, I mean, HAARP is all about scalar weaponry.
Mm-hmm.
It does also have something to do with the weather modification that's going on around the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And there are weather wars as well that people are not really, not very commonly talked about, even in the UFO community. But the ETs use weather the same way that our secret government does.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's a lot of weather wars going on. And apparently the Florida hurricane, that did all the devastation, was said to be the result of a weather war.
Mm. That's not the first time I've heard that. It's interesting. So the chemtrails could be part of the chemical soup that seems to be being dumped on the whole around the globe, but more specifically in well, for one thing, California is covered every day with chemtrails. So it seems like they are establishing a blanket of chemicals for some reason.
Well, yeah, and there are supposedly opiates and other things in this stuff that they put over, the film they put over, in the skies above us. Some of it could also, could be doing things like changing. They do tests on groups of populations.
Uh-huh.
And I have to say that this has not been something that we have been able to get direct information about from any of our sources. But what I'm talking about now are things that I've come across in my general research.
Okay.
Tom Bearden, for one thing, his book will tell you a great deal about this.
Okay. Wow. Well, you guys have given us a great deal to think about. I think we're coming close to the end of the hour, too. I would love to have you back on again sometime. I feel like we just barely scratched the surface.
Oh, well, thank you.
You would be very disappointed if in 2 or 3 months down the line we didn't have a lot more to talk about.
Oh, maybe you could throw in something here. A lot of people are talking about first contact, and James Gilliland has a lot of people going up to his ranch in Washington to see sightings and things. Does that seem like something that is on the horizon for us?
Well, this is interesting because we just attended the UFO Expo in Northern California a few days ago. And we met James Gilliland and were able to get a short interview with him and were invited to go up to Trout Lake. And we'd been planning to go up there this summer, but didn't have the wherewithal to get up there. It's quite a distance away for us. So we're basically invited to go up there with our cameras and film what's going on. And we fully intend to do so.
Oh, good.
James is again, a very engaging wonderfully mellow, soft-spoken guy, and a lovely person to meet, and seems to be completely on the level with what he's coming up with. As far as whether or not there's going to be first contact, one of our sources had told us that this was going to be the year of disclosure.
Uh-huh.
And this source is well-known in the UFO community, has some top secret government, I guess, intel from time to time. We heard that SERPO is obviously part of that, overall disclosure.
Mm.
And Dan Burrish and his material, he was under a mandate to get everything, the word out, by Christmas. This was his mandate, and he's done so by contacting us, coming forward with a full interview, and doing something that he calls, what does he call that process that he's going through?
Pass.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, he's doing a full disclosure.
Uh-huh.
And with a number of tapes, he's got tapes and tapes and tapes that was part of a mandate, again, for disclosure. So when you say first contact, now there's another element of first contact that actually Stephen Greer is coming forward in a news group that we've been a part of, which is Victor's news group. And he's talking about how his sources in the government are now saying that there's going to be a false first contact that the government is going to generate along with the help of some ETs, and that this may be sort of generated to create a feeling of fear in the populace and also to put people into a state in which they'll accept the idea of war with the aliens,
and then,
or at least
of course,
a group of aliens.
And then, of course, we'll need trillions and trillions of dollars for weapons in space.
Right.
It's kind of the similar situation David Icke talks about and we're all familiar with 9-1-1.
Exactly.
You know,
just what they say, what Greer is saying is an ET 9-1-1 event.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not his information is correct, I mean, it's certainly open to discussion. But it's interesting that he's coming forward now, that he obviously feels he needs to warn people on this level. And he's a guy that you'd want to listen to
Oh, absolutely.
Whether you agree with him or not.
Absolutely.
We are going to be interviewing David Icke, though. We're on our way to Europe. And,
oh, good.
We're going to be meeting with him. And so we hope to have an interview that we can post to the web very, very soon.
Oh, wonderful. Well, you guys are the unsung heroes of our time, I have to tell you. And
I have to say our witnesses are. I mean, you know,
well, you're doing a fantastic job out
there. We are not the story. They are the story.
Well, I sure appreciate you sharing your time with us today, and I want to have you back. And make sure that people visit your website, projectcamelot.org, and listen to the interviews that are taped, and read them if you can't download them. And people who are out there who have information, please, please, please contact these people and get the information out there. It's time to do that. So I thank you so much, both of you, and wish you just the best of luck in your venture, and I'll be in touch. I'm going to stay in touch.
Thank you so much, Lance. It's been a real pleasure. We hope to talk to you again soon.
Oh, thank you. Me too.
Thank you.
And this is a Fireside Chat, and I hope you've enjoyed it. And good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, folks.
Okay, thank you, Zany.